Hello, interweb. Welcome to Country Style Comics, the only podcast that reads Original Sin by Jason Aaron while reading Original Sin by Jonathan Edwards. I'm your host, Andrew Bowman. Of course, joining me as always is Dusty. We call him D.
How's it going?
And of course, we've got Isaac. We call him Possum.
Howdy.
All right. On this episode of Country Style Comics, we are mixing things up a little bit, and so we're recording via Skype. So if it sounds a little bit different than the last episode, we're still new to this. We're still tinkering and tankering with it. We appreciate you just kind of hanging in there with us. In this episode, we went all out into Batman, into the Dark Knight, the Caped Crusader. We watched Christopher Nolan's The Dark Knight, the second part of his Batman trilogy. Dusty read Batman Unwrapped, which is really just a sketch version of Batman Volume 1, The Court of Owls, part of the New 52. I read Batman Year 1, and Isaac read The Dark Knight Returns. So, that being said, I know this wasn't any of our first watching of The Dark Knight. It's been out for a while. It was highly anticipated when it came out. But that being said, having rewatched it, guys, what did you think?
Me personally, I enjoyed the movie just for the theatrical quality in itself. I think Christopher Nolan just does a good job with the all-around storyline and the mood and the atmosphere. It really lends itself to the title of Dark Knight. It's a little bit different than most of the traditional Batmans that we're kind of sort of used to, like the animated version and Adam West and whatnot. But the storyline's good. The action's good. It's just a good overall movie.
I have to agree. In terms of the Batman trilogy, I think it's by far my favorite. The first one is great. Don't get me wrong. But the second one, and for me to say that about a sequel, almost feels wrong in my mouth. But it did well. It really came through. I was actually disappointed because it kind of set the stage for the third one, and I was kind of expecting more. And I don't think the third one could even live up to the second one. I was really, really impressed. And one of the things that I really liked about it was the fact that they were able to take the characters and combine the live action or the thing that makes it listed with the almost larger-than-life characters that are in the comics. I think they did a really good job of making that happen.
Yeah, I think the Batman character is a phenomenal character, and it's a character that you can get gritty with and it not be too odd. I think that Christopher Nolan took some liberties, but he walked that line perfectly. To appeal to a new audience, you're going to have to do that. I mean, you're taking this thing from a 2D, a very 2D medium, and putting it into a more 3D medium, almost like when The Simpsons went to the Simpsons movie, right? Like they had to, even in the way the camera in The Simpsons movie, like, would be portrayed, you kind of had to see some things adjust. And so I think you see that kind of mentality in The Dark Knight and in all of Nolan's stuff, and he walked that line so incredibly well. It was very realistic, while at the same time it was a superhero movie, and you would say that when you walked out of there. This wasn't just a hero movie or an action movie. It was a superhero movie, and I think that, like you guys were saying, he done a great job. I don't think you're going to find anybody that's saying that Christopher Nolan didn't do fantastic work.
You got it right. One of the things that impresses me, and especially with this one, you've got the character of Batman, who of course is the mainstay title character, and then the quintessential nemesis for him, which is the Joker. If you think about the most well-known versions on the screen, you've got the Adam West and Cesar Romano that played the Joker. And that's kind of almost a goofy, kind of a playful good for children type thing. And then you've got 1989 with Tim Burton's Batman with Michael Keaton and Jack Nicholson. And Jack Nicholson made the character, you know, very literally psychotic, and but also kept the measure of whimsy, which is typical of Tim Burton. And then you come along with Christopher Nolan's portrayal of the same two characters, and they're able to evolve it even further to being crazy psychotic, as in terms of the Joker, to being realistically sadistic, and it works.
I do feel like, in one way, that as far as, I guess you'd say, the human psyche goes, it almost does feel like the Christopher Nolan versions are more relatable to reality, because it's like you were saying about the other two, they're a little more whimsical. This one, although as crazy as it is, and the darkness that's throughout the entire movie, like, I guess you'd say that it's just more relatable to human psychology, the way people actually act, kind of thing.
And you're starting to see that more as being a trend, especially even with superhero or comic book movies. You see that a lot, because I'm just thinking of certain examples, even with you know, new versions of Superman and even X-Men, and going across the, you know, comic book spectrum, you're starting to see ways to try to make more relatable to modern reality.
Yeah, and like you guys were saying, or we've been saying, Nolan does a fantastic job of this. And of course, this was directed by Christopher Nolan, written by him and his brother Jonathan, starring Christian Bale, Aaron Eckhart, Maggie Gyllenhaal, Gary Oldman, and of course Heath Ledger played a phenomenal, phenomenal Joker. He won the Oscar for Best Supporting Actor for his role as the Joker, even though he had passed away by the time the Oscars were held. But with us kind of thinking through the Joker character, what do you guys think about this? Do you think the Joker, especially portrayed in this movie, Christopher Nolan's Joker, is he chaotic, or is he a super planner? I think that you could almost say that he's a planner. The fact that the movie has a lineage of him kind of starting small in his mayhem and anarchy, and then kind of growing it up, that seems somewhat as if by design. But at the same time, he says directly to the Two-Face character when he's in the hospital that he's not a planner, that he hates the idea of plans, that he's trying to show people how dumb plans are. He's a dog after a car. He wouldn't know what to do with it if he caught it, is the line he uses. So what do you guys think? Is he chaotic or a super planner?
I'm going to have to say that I think I've went different ways on this when I think about it, but I think the conclusion I'm going to have to come to is that he's a little bit of both. And my reasoning for that is that you look at the things he did in the movie, starting with the fact that he stole money from the mob to get them realizing that they had to do something. Then he goes before them and tells them, "Hey, I stole your money and I can do it again." The guy who thinks he can keep it safe won't be able to. Then he, once Batman gets a hold of him, he's able to orchestrate events by manipulating not only Batman, but the police, to being able to get that guy and get the money. And making a bigger share for himself by eliminating the other competition. But the fact that gets me is, you know, at one point he says, "We got to kill the Batman." And then at another point he says, "No, I don't want to kill him. I like to play with him." I think that kind of hints the fact that he plans, but then he's open to change as well, and open to just doing what suits him. And the biggest evidence for that I see is at the end, whenever he's got the two boats there, he's got the bombs on each boat, and they've each got their opposite detonator, and they've got to detonate it before a certain time. And then when neither one of them does, he says, you know, I've got to do everything yourself. So he had planned that that might happen. So he was ready with his own detonator. But then in the middle of getting ready to detonate them both, which would have pretty much essentially give him what he wanted one way or the other, which was chaos, he stops to tell the story of how he got the scars, which I would have loved to have heard what he'd have told Batman, because those, you know, origins change, and that's a whole different conversation. But that's that shows me that he's open to planning, and he's very meticulous in his plans, but he's also open to changing those on a whim.
He's a planner, but he's not completely OCD.
Yeah, or I mean, not, I wouldn't even say OCD. I mean, he's an impulsive planner is the best way to put it.
Wouldn't you say someone who is a super planner, or at least a really good super planner, knows how to, I'm not saying can always foresee the obstacles that are going to come ahead of him, but when they do, he readjusts the plan. I think if you're a bad planner, then when your plan just goes awry, you're like, oh, shucks, there goes my plan, and you're just kind of stuck. So I think that maybe he's able to end the chaos. Yeah,
I don't think you can say
yes. I think that just says yes.
I don't think you can say someone's a super planner if they're improvising. So, I mean, I see where you're coming from, but I don't agree. I think he is a super planner, but I think he often improvises part of his plan, or maybe even he just leaves room to do it.
The only way that I would disagree with that is when you're playing chess. I mean, don't get me wrong. No, just because the knight took my bishop, that's not chaos. But you have to plan at least to a certain extent for those pieces being taken, for this plan that I have to take his king. It's not going to work out exactly the way I want it to right when I start the game. That's the whole point of chess. And I think in that way, it works the same way. Does it make me a super planner?
I can see it just the opposite, because chess, I could see it being a game of super planning, because there's a large number of possibilities, but there still is a set number of possibilities. Whereas what Joker does, think about how many variables there are. I mean, it's infinite. So I don't know if you could really maybe he is a super planner, but I would say that just as a contrast, you might say that the Joker is a super planner who improvises more, and Batman is an improviser who plans more.
Almost like musicians, like he's jazz. Jazz is good, is someone playing an instrument well, but it doesn't mean they sat down ahead of time and was like, well, to play this trumpet well, I need to hit this note here, and it needs to be followed by this note there, and then
improv,
and, you know, this many quarter beats, I need to hit this note, right? Like, jazz is fantastic musicianship. Like, yeah, absolutely, but it's primarily improv. But, and I may be siding a little more with D here on the a little more chaotic minded, because I think we would all agree, at least to a large extent, Batman is a planner. Batman is a calculate the variables, figure out what it is. He's the master chess player. His chessboard is life. And if Joker is supposed to be the flip side of Batman, you would almost have to say he's chaotic. Now that may not necessarily be the case, because you could make, once again, going back to the music argument, you could say that you could make a case that the opposite of classical is jazz, not really bad music. Like, you know what I mean? Like, they all have to exist in this form to be compared to each other. So maybe they are both planners, but just kind of like what Dusty was saying, the way they plan. Batman's is ahead of time, step it out, here's what it looks like. And Joker's is more of jazz. His is on every step, I make the right move, planned it out. Yeah. Because it's like I said, small to big. He has a game plan. You know what I mean? Like, he wants to
win. Yeah, he's good enough. I know we keep using the music reference, but there. That's the whole point of, like you were saying about jazz, is I have this set, and this is kind of the way it's supposed to sound, but I'm good enough at what I do, and I know what I'm doing well enough that I can throw in this little thing. And if somebody else throws in this little thing, I can still make it sound good.
Another possibility that I'm considering too is maybe they're both kind of starting out. I mean, the way that we're kind of describing it, the way that I originally kind of thought about it was, you know, if they've got two things that make up a whole, and it's super planning versus chaos, or impulsivity, or improvising, whatever you want to call it. And then you look at the two containers being Batman and the Joker. One might have one more of one thing and less of the other, while the other has just the opposite. But something I'm starting to consider is maybe if you start them both out as super planners as being the base, and then the improvisation or the deviation from the plan, or the changing of it, or the extent of it gets changed based on the personality, I still think that would speak to volumes to the Joker, because if you think about what his mental faculties are in terms of, you know, psychosis versus sanity, maybe the super planning part is the what part of him that is sane, and then, but he has to be, because he's so crazy, and everybody can agree he is just crazy, the impulsivity or the improvising part has to be so much more phenomenal. So to kind of counteract it, if you're thinking about it in terms of balances and personality.
That's a good way of
putting it. Maybe that doesn't make any sense. Yeah.
No, I can get it.
I don't know.
No, I think I see where you're coming from. I think what we're really getting to the point is, the more we kind of talk about it and think about it, is the fact that they may be closer to the same thing than we realize. It's just where they start from that makes the difference. Like, I guess in my mentality is, Batman starts everything from the head, never the heart. And you could almost make the case that Joker's is somewhat of the opposite. Is he loves seeing things wrecked. It's all about what makes him happy. And so he wants to see that fulfilled. And so he'll set a game plan out to see that happen. But I think that you might could make the case that it's, you know, your where you start from is going to largely determine what route you take. And I think that maybe that's it, is, you know, Batman starts more from the head and Joker more... I don't want to necessarily say from the heart, because I think we associate that with like love and gushiness, and we would not associate Joker with love and gushiness. But it's definitely more.
Ultimately, the Joker's goal, well, basically, in its most simple form, his goal is anarchy. So, I mean, when you plan towards anarchy, he's planning towards chaos. So, I mean, really,
a lot more options to get into that than there is to order it, isn't it?
Yeah, pretty much. So
I guess that's why he can be so versatile. You know,
I was going to say, in that sense, I don't know if I could call him a super planner. Is he a decent planner? Yeah, but his goal is, like I said, anarchy. His goal is chaos.
Well, and that makes sense given, you know, this going back to the scenario of the two boats. He's wanting to see, you know, Gotham City blow up other people just, you know, to save their own rear or whatever reason. Yeah, and then, okay, well, they're not going to do it, so I'm just going to blow them all up. So, you know, that's the alternative to still getting the chaos, or he could have said, well, I'm going to blow up everybody that's, you know, listening in, or I'm going to take out the cops that are trying to get on the boats, or, you know, different things. There could have been a million different ways he could have caused chaos, but he did the one that suited his purpose and had the biggest visibility, I suppose.
He's just a good plan B planner.
There you go.
Dusty, you had mentioned earlier about his scars, and in the movie we hear him give two stories, and then he references an origin story with Batman, and I think that we probably would say it's probably not going to be the same one if he's told two different ones, and we kind of sit here and go, oh man, I would have loved to know the web he would have spun to kind of feed into Batman's psyche. But what do you guys think was Nolan's mindset behind this? I mean, Nolan is fantastic writer and director. Like, this isn't an accident. It's not like Heath Ledger forgot the first story and he ends up telling a second one and they're like, brilliant, we'll leave it. Like, it's got to be some mentality. What do you guys think's the deal in this movie with Joker's multiple origin stories?
One of the things that I was quite impressed that was done that way. I remember whenever the movie first came out, or the first time I saw it, rather, it made me interested. Well, how did Joker become the Joker? Because, you know, you go back to Tim Burton's Batman, and it shows he was just a mob hired hand, or even if you want to say he's one of the ringleaders of one of the gangs, and but Batman throws him into a vat of chemicals and it causes him to go crazy and bleaches his skin and all that fun stuff. That makes it a little bit more, going back to what we were talking about, whimsical. But this one is a little different, and then you don't see him become the Joker. You just see the Joker show up. That makes me wonder, you know, where he was during the first Batman. Was he in Gotham City during Batman Begins, or was he in Arkham Asylum when Dr. Crane and then Ra's al Ghul allow the people to get loose?
I definitely think in the first movie they reference him as, not that they know for sure because they can't ID him, obviously, but I think that they reference the fact that his origin was probably something like coming from Arkham. Now, of course, that's not, you know, a solid origin story by any means, but...
Well, yeah, and it doesn't explain the scars either. So one of the things I did was actually go to try to find out, you know, between internet sources or, you know, wiki links and things like that. And one of the things that I found out was that there is no canon story for his origin. There are several... And which kind of goes along with the idea that he told multiple stories, which makes you wonder, well, which one is true. And I think it really, considering the character and how big he becomes and how much larger than life and just crazy is the best way I can describe it, because, you know, he's just so out there. I don't know that I could come up with a story that would be suitable to explain how he gets to the point that he does. I'm afraid that if somebody tried, it might fall short and it would take away some of his mystique. I really like the fact that you're not sure. It makes, considering how big Batman is, and you think about his origin story, I mean, it's pretty intense. It's pretty, you know, awesome, for lack of a better word. So the nemesis of Batman has to have an equally awesome story, or one that you can't confirm, so it's that mysterious.
It is ironic that it would be seen that his origin story is completely up for grabs, and the Batman origin story is a solid. Yeah. It is not changing. In all the ways that DC may be tinkering with storylines, they never touch the Batman. He's coming home from the opera, he gets mugged, and his parents get shot. Now, of course, there can be a little bit of playroom, but it is always it's a very solid origin story.
I think it's even been more concrete than even Superman's.
I was thinking the exact same thing. I think it is as well. Just kind of either poke a hole into my own theory or maybe even Nolan's, because I really do think in the end of the first movie they kind of reference, like, this guy probably came from Arkham. But if Arkham is a decent holding for sociopaths, like criminals, or just criminals in general, if it's somewhat of a prison, wouldn't you think they would document scars and tattoos, right? Isn't that what you normally do? You if you arrest a criminal that's anything near high profile, you document these things so that you can...
Unless he got them afterwards.
So wouldn't you have... That's what I'm thinking, is the scars, if he came from Arkham, which is a big if, he had to have got the scars afterward, because wouldn't you assume that would have been documented and pretty easily found? Hey, wait a minute, this guy may have escaped from Arkham. Hey, wait a minute, both sides of his face are slit like a pumpkin. Let me try to cross-reference that in this nice Batcave thing I own, right? Like, seems like that would have came
up. But at the same time, because of that, like, or at least, and I guess that lends itself more to the movie itself, like, nothing is known about the Joker. Like, even when the police, when the detectives look into him, like, no fingerprints, no, like, zero. Like,
well,
he's completely self-made, even to the point that they even propose that he makes his own clothes.
Well, that's also, you can, because remember, Commissioner Gordon didn't have any clue of how many got off the island or out of Arkham because they couldn't find the records. That could be thanks to the lovely Dr. Crane for doing his experiments or the different things that he did in creating his fear gas. There's a lot of different possibilities on that too. But I still think it kind of lends itself to the fact that Joker's too awesome to have a mediocre story. And you said something that really made me think, which was talking about how Batman's story is so concrete, it's orderly. So it would make sense that the Joker's would be chaotic or unsolid, almost in contrast to it.
I like that theory. Because of that, like, that's part of our intrigue to the Joker and Batman storyline. Like, that's 90% of the point, is Batman has this super strict moral guideline, if you will, and the Joker's just like, whatever, let's blow stuff up. And There's pretty much nothing solid about Joker's story, period. And for there to be an origin story, like, I mean, just pretty much repeating everything that we said.
And if you think about the two stories that we do hear him give, the base elements of those are very different. If the story about his dad did it to him, right? Like his dad was mean and abusive, so his dad did it to him. This thing that was done to him, who he is, was inflicted upon him. And then in the other story, he does it to himself, right? Like his wife gets torn up, and so he does this act to himself. So it's kind of like self-made. One of them is, although really odd, it's kind of an act of love. Hey, I love my wife. I want her to see my love for her, so I'm going to deface myself. Whereas the other one is from an act of hatred and no love at all. His father, who obviously it's not an act of love, comes and does this to him. So even the stories have very, at their base, very opposing points.
Well, that makes me think that a lot of what he said was catering to the moment, and that kind of goes back to what we're talking about, super planning versus impulsivity. I think him telling that story based on who he was telling, I think it suited the situation. So he was manipulating or using it to his advantage of the situation, which makes me think I'd love to know what the story was that he was going to tell Batman.
Isaac, what was the story he was going to tell Batman?
That he was a child and fell down a well and scraped his face.
By a bat?
Exactly.
The bat scraped his face into a Joker. I don't think that's at all what he was going to say. Maybe an arrowhead did it.
Because
that's what he finds with...
That's what he stole from her, remember?
Ah, gotcha. Yeah. Yep.
You illiterate person.
Well, that makes sense.
See? Gotta be paying attention or not at all. All right, so one of the other things that I noticed as I watched this movie again is the idea of, should Batman be copied in Gotham or by us? One of the first scenes, really the opening scene for Batman in the movie, is, yes, he is taking down these two crime bosses. He's taking down Scarecrow and part of the mob, but he's also stopping the copycat Batman. In fact, when he leaves, you just kind of see the Scarecrow as a part of that group, and kind of gives this, you know, offhanded remark about that's not his diagnosis. But it really focuses when he leaves on his copycats, and then he doesn't really want he doesn't want copycats at all, and he sees Harvey Dent as a better version of him, a fulfillment of the partial that he is, I guess. So what do you guys think? Should Batman be copied in Gotham or by us? You can hit either one of those.
Well, I think this is where the Christopher Nolan Batman tends to differ a little bit from some of the comics that I've read and some of the other movies, in my opinion. But one of the things that I think this movie kind of gives is that Batman doesn't... He sees himself, or the persona of Batman, as a necessary evil. And I don't mean evil in the sense of being bad, but rather it's something he doesn't want to do. It's a necessary burden, maybe, is a better way to put it.
It's a justified war. War isn't good, but it's sometimes justified to prevent horrible...
Right, I mean, because he things. Said... And they go into, especially towards the end, he's not the thing that... He's, you know, he's what Gotham City
not
deserves.
The hero Gotham needs, but the one it deserves.
Right. And I think what it lends itself to, and that's why he held up Harvey Dent so much, is that Batman wants people who have the ability to take responsibility.
Yeah, I think I kind of think you're right on that one, Dusty. I think as much as we tend to get drawn toward the Batman character, and even in most of the comics, he is a darker superhero. By no means is he the darkest, but he is a relatively darker one compared to the Flash, Superman, even the Green Lantern, depending on which one it is. But for the most part, they seem to be clean cut. The Batman character is one we're drawn to, but it's not one that at least Christopher Nolan in this movie would say it's where we should land completely. That Christian Bale's character wants to grow past that. He wants to find a time where he can lay down his cape, where he doesn't have to do that. He sees Harvey Dent as what he can do, but better.
I think, I mean, if you think about just the title in itself and the ending remarks of the movie, I mean, if you know, which I don't claim to know a lot, but if you know a little bit about kind of medieval lore and whatnot, the Dark Knight was kind of that, hey, we need this guy to take care of this small army of bandits, what have you. We don't really necessarily like the guy, but he's going to help us. He's what we need right now. This is, well, like it says at the end of the movie, the watchful protector. He takes care of the dirty business. Even though it's dirty, it needs to be done for the good of the city or the kingdom, what have you. And versus Harvey Dent, he's the White Knight that it refers to.
So to interrupt you a little bit, so like the this Dark Knight, that was a thing in like when?
It's yeah. In medieval lore, the idea of the Dark Knight. It's not, I guess the best way to put it is.
Is it like King Arthur? Like I mean, not really real, but kind of real?
Yeah, it's like one of those things. It's a story about, you know, the bad guy who does the good stuff or that kind of thing.
Yeah. I mean, it's not like a super solid thing, But
it's, I know what he's talking about.
I use the word lore, just because it's not like a, hey, this is written down, you know.
That's why there's all these Dark Knights
and all these kingdoms.
Well, that's why the comic books call him the Dark Knight with K-N-I-G-H-T. It's a play on that old archetype.
Now, I knew it was obviously referencing with the K-N-I-G-H-T. I knew it was obviously referencing like a protector, but I just thought it was referencing like a knight as in, you know, your protector, and he's a dark one. He's not like, you know, the pristine one that you would look at and be like, ooh, that's awesome, necessarily. But yeah, I had no idea this was anything outside of a name for Batman.
Nah, that, I mean, pretty much exactly what you said sums it up. Like, the Dark Knight is the one that, well, like I said, does the dirty work because nobody else wants to, but it does need to be done in this particular situation.
He's not the honorable one, but he's the one that's able.
The White
Knight. Huh, the more you know.
The White Knight is the honorable. He's the one that takes care of, I don't want to say the business side, but that's kind of sort of, in a way, that's what it is. Like, he's the face. He's the one that leads the guys into battle and says, you know, I'm all great, like you said, knight in shining armor, what we typically think of.
Yeah, and that kind of goes to what we're talking about is Batman does not want to be somebody to be emulated. He wants to be – he's necessary, and he realizes that. He wants people like Harvey Dent who take a honest approach, because he has to beat the, you know, living tar out of people in order to get, you know – and it's not justice. He is a vigilante. He is outside of the law. But he wants people who are inside of the law to be inspired to do their responsibility and their job.
Very good way of putting it.
So now that being said, which I think has been a discussion definitely worth having in this part of it, we would all agree, I think if we were taking a show of hands or a say of eyes, that we would all agree that our world is at best not perfect. I think we would all at least say that's true. I would say that, but then again, my wife roots for Seattle and they just lost the Super Bowl, so I would definitely say it's an imperfect world. So that being said, what do we take up that banner? At what point does this Dark Knight character become necessity? Does he become extremely useful? Do we carry on his gauntlet, or do we emulate more of a Superman ideology that says, I'm going to be in the sun and draw the darkness, draw people out of the darkness to me, right? Like the classic Superman movie line, you know, you'll be like the sun, you know, you'll draw them up, kind of thing. So, what do y'all think? What do real-time Earth, not Gotham, not Metropolis, not this this wrote down on a piece of paper in DC comic book, us living in the United States in a world that's not perfect, how do we handle that?
Well, I think it comes down to, you can even look at, as the United States as a country, it's in our Declaration of Independence in saying that those who have the power to act have the responsibility to act. So as a nation and having pride in that, I would say those who have the ability have the responsibility.
So it's lending, at least in that individual statement, it's lending itself to a Dark Knight.
How so? What do you mean?
Like, I know, as Dusty was talking about, I think it was in the Declaration of Independence. And Thomas Jefferson also makes a point. I can't remember exactly how it's phrased. I'm just honestly not sure. He makes the statement that basically if the government becomes too powerful/tyrannical, that the people should overthrow it. I mean, and that lends itself to the other comment that Dusty made.
It's along those same lines. He says, it's the duty of that people to throw off such governments.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, and in that sense, I mean, it may take something drastic if the situation were to come that it becomes tyrannical or what have you, that we would need a necessary evil, if you will, to overcome a greater evil. And I think that's the whole point of the Dark Knight, even in the medieval and the Batman.
I mean, come, I see the
fire with fire.
Yeah.
I mean, I see what you guys are saying, and I definitely see it unfold in the comic books. But I mean, in real life, like people to people, I mean, I think that you know, Gordon says at the end of the first one, when he holds up the Joker card, when he references it for the first time, he says, you know, we put on bulletproof vests, they get armor-piercing rounds. Like, doesn't that at some point only lend to escalation? If you get tougher, they get tougher. If you get tougher, they get tougher. Like, or is there a time in which your good tougher trumps the bad tougher to the point that they're no longer bad tougher?
I don't think that that's the case. I think it just escalates because, I mean, if you've seen, I mean, technology, war, famine, I mean, the troubles that humanity faces, disease, it all has escalated since the beginning of time.
So what you're saying is war, really, what is it good for? I mean, I think we could say it's absolutely nothing.
Wow.
Heck, I'll...
Ooh, wow. Yeah.
Come on, it was right there. I had to take it.
I tend to think that it's not necessarily... I mean, I have that kind of mentality, and I realize it's a cultural thing because I'm from a nation of rebels. I'm from a country that started by fighting, and that's how our country is. That's how that's the mentality of our country. If we don't like what we got, we fight for better.
I think that's one of the things that makes the Batman-Superman dynamic such a one that everyone in comic books loves. I mean, people like Batman, people like Superman. A lot of people like both. But their dynamic, whether they work together or somewhat against each other, people love that friction because, like you said, we do see that one doesn't seem to... We see the pitfalls in both, and we wrestle with ourselves. Where do I... When do I do what? There has to be a time where if I'm just completely given, people are going to run over me. I won't have anything to give, and I'm no help to anyone. But also that sometimes tough upon tough upon tough just leads to an escalation of toughness where what do you have to do then to justify killing or destroying the evil? It's this very much this back and forth hard to for us
well,
as
and- – I think you're right. I think Superman and Batman, that dynamic is very complex because they're both doing the same job, which is, you know, battling the forces of evil. But then you've got one who's doing it, you know, all the so-called right ways, living up to a higher standard, and he's the white knight, so to speak, and that will be Superman. And then you've got Batman, who hides in the shadows and gets really violent and gets in your face and is a lot more elusive and deceptive. And I think it's unique that they chose that the one who can't compensate with supernatural abilities compensates with the darker. So it's almost implied that you can only be perfect and good if you have no vulnerabilities. I don't know, but I think that's I think you pointed out a really good dynamic, and I think that's people really like that and really see that. And in terms of vanquishing evil, I don't think that's possible. That's why I think escalation happens because Evil is just as, and that this is in the real world with disease and war as it is in the comic book world. It's so ever changing and regenerating that you have to. On the good side of that, you have to be completely escalating and always changing to be able to combat and keep it at bay.
Yeah. Well, I think it's safe to say that in the time that we've talked about this, we have fully exhausted Christopher Nolan's The Dark Knight and really touched on all the points and just got him well-rounded and to a consensus that this is how that looks. Not. All right. So we're going to go ahead and move on to the comic books we read. And Dusty, I don't think you like my Knot. Can I not bring Knot back? Is that not doable?
We'll see.
I'm bringing it back. I'm letting you know. It's happening, man. All right.
Prepare your face. It's happening.
don't you forget it, Dusty. You read Batman Unwrapped, volume one of the New 52s, The Court of Owls. It was written by Scott Snyder and illustrated by Greg Cuyo, and it's a collection of the Batman New 52s from issues 1 to 7. What were your thoughts? What's it about?
Well, this was my first time reading anything in this particular series, and I found it very interesting.
What do you mean by this particular series?
The New 52.
Nice.
So it was something to get me. My appetite was wet by this. So, I mean, I'm really looking forward to reading some of the ones that come after this. I had looked up in my reading about, you know, the origins of Batman and the origins of Joker and stuff. I remember reading about the Court of Owls, but I didn't go too much in depth with it because it just didn't, you know, speak to me at the time because I was reading it on the surface. But this particular comic book focuses on the fact that there's an elusive group in Gotham called the Court of Owls that kind of running everything and has their hands in everything. It's almost like the Gotham's version of the Illuminati, being a theory where there's some group that, you know, controls everything in the world. And it seems like they decide to make their target Bruce Wayne and also Batman. And then they find out that those targets are the same. And Batman goes through a trial and a crisis of his own abilities, because you find out that one of his first cases, or his first time being a detective, was in search of the Court of Owls. It was an old legend. It's supposed to be based on an old poem, and that's part of Gotham lore, Gotham history. And
real quick, I know that I've read it and Isaac's read it. What did you think of the poem?
It was interesting.
They inserted like this kind of nursery rhyme type thing. I thought it seemed very... It was really well done. It was very simple, but it just keep referencing. I thought it was fantastic.
I liked it a lot. Yeah. It played the story very well.
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah.
Sorry.
And,
catch up.
No, that's fine. And I liked how it took you back to... You know, we tend to think of the origin story of Batman going back to, you know, when he starts training and traveling the world and becoming... But then this one takes it even farther back to, you know, right after his parents' death. Before he ever, you know, thinks about, you know, personifying a human bat or anything of that nature, he believes there's a darker force at work in his city, Gotham, that conspired to destroy his parents. And he does everything he could in his capacity as being a wealthy individual, but still being a child. And he thought he'd come close, but then he kind of just doubted that it even existed, only to find out years later that it did, and that it does. So I thought it was interesting how it went back to Batman's origins even farther than most of the things I'd read before that. It was a very good, very good, well done.
Yeah, Isaac, I know that that you read this. In fact, the copy he read, he borrowed from you. Didn't you say that you liked it when you read it the first time?
Oh, yeah, I loved it. I mean, it was just because it was a new launch of a different series, I assume. I mean, the story was vastly different. But the way it was written, and in all honesty, part of the whole thing about the poem, like that one was, the whole thing was very poetic, and I love the way it was laid out. I loved it pretty much.
No, like I said, I've read it. I thought it was fantastic. Dusty, you said this was your first jump into the New 52. I've read a couple things out of the New 52. This has been, and I'm a Superman fan most of the time, but this is by far the best thing I've read out of it. It is a phenomenal story. What's something that kind of caught your eye, or like kind of wrapped in your head as you were reading it?
Well, one of the things that it starts out talking about, and it spends a pretty good amount of time towards the center of the comic, is talking about the idea of what Gotham is, and what I mean by that is they make a statement that oftentimes people would describe Gotham as Gotham is, and then insert adjective here. And it would be something depending on, you know, the time that you're looking at it, and especially in the time of Batman, it was lawless, it was crazy, it was all kinds of these negative adjectives. And in the comic, it would give a montage of all those rogues gallery that Batman has. Batman struggled with it as well, trying to define what Gotham was and Gotham is, and how that related to him. And what kind of, how do you answer that? And that makes me think of also something else we've already talked about, which was the idea of emulating Batman, kind of include that. Is Gotham Batman? Is Gotham his city? Is it his place to own or to call it? You know, we tend to think of Metropolis as being the Man of Steel's place, his city. But is it really his? Is it his responsibility? Because technically, Batman has more claim to Gotham than Superman ever will to Metropolis, just because he's been born there.
Gotham is very much personified in this graphic novel a lot, and more so than I think than most of the Batmans that I've read. And Gotham has always seemed to be personified, at least some. I mean, the new Batman-esque TV show, right, is called Gotham, right? Like, I mean, they actually use the title of the city as the name of the show, which we don't see DC doing in their other shows, Arrow, The Flash. They have a different feel, but still the point stands. And it's a very interesting concept. Like you're saying, it's Gotham is so much more a part of the Batman character than, you know, Metropolis is to Superman or any of these other things that you would see.
Well, it makes me think of going back to Batman Begins in terms of the movies. Gotham is seen as kind of the end-all be-all of evil or humanity run amok, or humanity's profanity. That's why, you know, Ra's al Ghul decides he's got to destroy him, or destroy rather Gotham. And, you know, even this comic tends to describe Gotham as being a great city that became a cesspool, that built a nice, you know, roof over a cesspool. And that's where, you know, when Batman, in the comic book, Batman ends up lost in the whatever, the sanctum of the owls or whatever, and it's underneath the city.
I ended up going into something, I read something a little darker. I read Year One, and it is by Frank Miller. It was a four-issue story arc that ran in the late 80s, and it's was illustrated and colored by David Mazzucchelli, I believe that's how you say that, and Richmond Lewis. It's a fantastic book. This is the first time I'd read it, and it was really good. It really explains the origin story of, honestly, it kind of starts out with the origin story of Jim Gordon is who it opens up on, him coming into the city to greet, or actually him coming in to meet his wife Barbara, because they just moved there, while at the same time Bruce Wayne is flying into the city. And it does a fantastic job of just kind of explaining these two differences of training in versus flying in. But it kind of sets up on how Batman gets started, and the process he goes through in landing back in Gotham and trying to be Batman, and what that looks like, and then with Jim kind of trying to be a good detective as an imperfect person in a very corrupt city with very corrupt cops and very corrupt politicians and all this. It's a fantastic novel, and I liked it a lot. One of the things that stuck out to me as I was reading this, and I read it right after I watched the Dark Knight, is does Gotham want to be saved? And the reason that it kind of jumped out to me the most is in one of the scenes, Batman, or really he's Bruce Wayne, he's not even dressed up as Batman, but he is kind of undercover. He's wearing grungy clothes. He's got a lot of himself covered up with a hoodie and jacket and stuff. And he's got a lot of himself covered up, and even puts a distinguishing scar on his face, so no one would think that he's someone else. And he goes to save this very, very young prostitute, may have been a kid. And when he goes to, like, fight her, what's a nice word for pimp?
Liaison.
when he goes to, like, deck, she, like, gets mad and stabs him in the leg. And so you're just kind of like, what is this? And so there's this dichotomy of he's trying to protect this girl, he's trying to help this girl, and she does not at least appreciate it, if want anything to do with it. So this idea of does Gotham want to be saved was just one that kind of jumped out to me, and it was one I was kind of wrestling with.
I would say probably yes and no. I guess maybe the best way to put it is Gotham doesn't realize it needs to be saved. And this is coming from my point of view as a mental health worker. In counseling, they say that the greatest percentage or the greatest factor for efficacy of therapy is the person's desire to do better, the person's desire to want to change. And but a lot of times if you end up in working with someone who is, you know, mandated by court, or especially if you're doing a minor who can't really decide whether they want to do counseling or not, it's up to their legal guardian, a lot of times you're having to try to convince someone who doesn't think they need help, that they need help. And I think that's the story of Batman.
What, in your experience, what brings a person to that point where they then want to get help?
maturity, oftentimes, or or lack of options. I'm just thinking, you know, it tends to be with adults in terms of therapy or counseling that they realize they're something's off or they can't function a certain way, so they realize they need to change, something needs to change, or they need help. With children, oftentimes it's a matter of they don't have an option, or the options that they have are so bad that they're willing to, you know, try what this, you know, this crazy guy or crazy woman's saying to try to make them better. And I think that speaks to what Batman does, is, you know, he's trying to save these people, whether or not they're crying out for a savior.
He's Gotham's psychiatrist.
Well, I wasn't just going with psychological disorders. I was just using that as an example, but
no, I mean
I see what you're saying. That further example, yeah, he's Gotham's shrink.
That was just a very general metaphor. I mean,
I don't know. There's a lot of things in the Batcave. I don't think I've seen a sofa in any of the layouts that I've run across.
Oh, I bet he's got one. Man.
Who would lay on that sofa? Let's be Alfred. Real about this. No, he wouldn't. You think Alfred, this prim, proper British butler, is going to be like laying down on the job and doing?
I can't think of anybody.
Bastard.
In terms of their psyche, than Alfred Pennyworth.
Say what now?
I can't think of anybody more who's been psychologically scarred by Batman than Alfred Pennyworth.
Oh, I'm not arguing that. I'm just saying that I just don't see anyone.
He needs the couch.
He needs the couch. It's not a matter of he wants it. He needs it.
He's came to that point. He now realizes he needs the couch.
Well, rock bottom, man.
Look, I'm enough.
Gotcha. But I digress.
Yeah, I really liked that point that you brought up about people realizing they need help, and before they can actually take it. I think maybe that's one of the things that the Batman character wrestles with, is that maybe one of the reasons why he has to be the Dark Knight is the fact that his city doesn't realize yet they need help, whereas you might can make the case that Superman's city does and are just looking for the right means, motive, opportunity to get that out. But Gotham doesn't. They have no idea how broke they are. And,
I think that's personified by the people who support a vigilante who's outside the law, or whether they don't. Because if you think about Gotham being a corrupt city and their police force being corrupt and everything, I think it's part of the irony of the character and part of the irony of the city that the ones who are realizing and who are enlightened enough to realize they need a savior are the ones who are supporting someone who's outside the law. Because the law is corrupt. It's kind of a neat little play on good and bad.
Yeah, and I think it's hard for people to see the fact that they need help, even if someone, you know, is yelling at them, "Hey, you need help." It's not always just, "Oh, well, okay, I can obviously see that." I mean, we make mistakes for years and years and years, and then a decade later we look back and go, gosh, 22-year-old Andrew was an idiot, but I think 26-year-old Andrew's awesome. But I'm almost positive that 32-year-old Andrew's going to think 26-year-old Andrew's an idiot. Like, it's just, it's kind of, it's how we are. Like, we're just so wired in this, and I think we see this really on display, fleshed out in a way that good literature and good comics do, is they don't tell you they're talking about you or humanity in general, but they're talking about you, right? Like this is who we are.
That's a quality in a good author.
I was gonna say, I think that's the point of good literary works, is like to make it as relatable as possible without making it smack you in the face and be like, this is you.
So, like I said, I read Year One by Frank Miller. Isaac, you read The Dark Knight Returns by Frank Miller. He never said that these were in the same arc, that these were the same Batman, but I think that if you've read both of them, you could definitely make that case. So, definitely flows into it. What did you think of The Dark Knight Returns? Like I said, it was written by Frank Miller, illustrated by Frank Miller and Klaus Janson. And it was a four-issue miniseries that came out in 86, just about a year before the Year One came out. So what did you think of it?
Given that I'm still new to comics, this was only my second reading of any type of Batman. I thoroughly enjoyed it. Jumping into critiques, it was extremely extensive. And it's sometimes somewhat hard to follow, but the overall storyline, basically Bruce Wayne as Batman, he's on up in his years. He's getting older. He's left as Batman. I think it says in the comic for 10 years, I believe. That there just hasn't been a Batman. He just hasn't done it. And it's slowly gotten back into this cesspool, as we called it earlier. It's just progressively gotten worse and worse. And then eventually he takes up the banner again and becomes Batman once again. He gets tired of the shape that Gotham is in. It's in such a devastating state that he just can't handle it anymore. It speaks to Batman's character in that he just has this mentality, like we were talking about earlier, is kind of the necessary evil thing, is he has to be the one to fix this. That's his mindset, is there's no other option. He has to be this Dark Knight. He's got to get his hands dirty. He's got to fix things, no matter how old and decrepit that he is. Batman is the necessary evil for Gotham. Like I said earlier, the story is very complex, but one of the most interesting points to me is later on in the story, it starts lending itself towards passing on the torch. And I guess it's mainly just odd to me just thinking about Bruce Wayne, not Batman. I mean,
that kind of goes to what we were talking about in terms of the emulating him, that we saw in Dark Knight. For a long time, it's different media. He's personified as not wanting people to do that or not wanting Batman to be necessary. But then after going without Batman, he realizes Gotham need Batman.
Kind of necessary. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That's the only thing that I guess kind of solidifies it for me is he is in the end. He's like, we're going to train here. We're going to do this. This is how we're going to do it. Start a new Batcave. But one of the also things that just adds to the oddities in a way, and I guess kind of goes back to the whole super planner thing, that he has to be the one to show them how to do this, how to be the detective that they're supposed to be, how to be this Dark Knight, the quote unquote savior of Gotham.
Now, I've seen the animated one. I've not read the comic, but from what I understand, it follows pretty close. And in one scene in the animated version, Batman kind of takes control of these gangs, and he pulls out a gun and says, these are loud noisemakers. We're not going to use these. We're going to use our fists and our wits. and we're going to take back Gotham. We're going to, you know, create order. And it lends me to the idea of, you know, as much as we've been sitting here talking about Batman being the darker evil or the, you know, getting dirty type thing, he set a standard too. He's got a role, even him in terms of his going against the grain and kind of going against the norm or the goody image of Superman. He also has a set of standards or morals that he follows, even if they're not exactly the same.
So now I know that I have read this one, and Isaac, I know at the end of it, he steps down, like you were saying. What'd you think about that? This idea of him, Bruce Wayne, kind of passing on the torch. What were your thoughts on that kind of really unique part of this story?
Well, that's what I was talking about earlier. Is like the number one thing. I mean, I know, or at least to me, I feel like this whole novel lends itself to just kind of a completion story of Batman, and because it's just basically impossible to picture Batman not being Bruce Wayne. I mean, just because the story's so ingrained in every idea that is Batman, like we were talking about the origin story, it's so concrete. Like, this is the character that we've come to know and come to appreciate and fall in love with, if you will. And I don't know, I guess the best way to put it is it just feels weird because Bruce Wayne's not going to be Batman anymore. Is it a good thing that he is passing on this torch? Yes, I believe so. Just the way the story's laid out, because he's old, because he can't handle himself or the criminals like he used to be able to. There is, because there's still a need for a Batman type character, there is a need to pass on the torch. But it's just weird to think about somebody being a Batman other than the original Batman, Bruce Wayne.
Aren't there's some series where like the whenever Batman's back is broken by Bane, and I'm thinking of a couple others where Batman puts different people into the position of Gotham's protector for a time, and it doesn't work out well. Even with Robin and stuff, who had been, you know, fighting with him for so long and knew how he did things and why he did things and the way he did them. But it still didn't quite work out the way we as the reader and Bruce Wayne as Batman thinks it should. And he always comes back. But then I'm also thinking about one of the new storylines that they've opened up, which is Batman Inc. And that's where Batman's becoming a franchise. And not only is Bruce Wayne Batman, but so is half a dozen other people.
Yeah, I remember you telling us about that story. I haven't read it yet.
I haven't gotten a chance to read it either.
I think it's funny that it's ironic because his character seems to lead him to be this very isolated character. Especially if you follow any of like Justice League stuff, especially the old 90s like animated series, he's very much isolated. But if you think about him in relationship to Superman, he's had so many more partners than Superman has. And it's funny because and just kind of doing some research for the podcast, one of the things I found was that Robin was supposed to be just this one-time character. But when the sales of that comic doubled any previous one, he stayed around. So apparently all it took for Batman to become not so isolated was really, really, really good sales. That was the key to make him be a little more friendly. So I thought that was hilarious, but just something that was unique to his character. I think what it kind of stems from in the fact that we see him pass it along, and even relating to the movie we watched in the third Batman, he passes along the gauntlet too, right, to the cop whose name is Robin, right? Like he passes along his gauntlet. Man, I think this just kind of shows us that we as a people, like, we need a hero, and we know this, like we know we need a saving, and so we always need that. Like, even when Batman has done his duty for literally a lifetime and puts it down, like, it's not fixed, we're still broken, there still needs to be someone swooping in and saving the day.
I like that analogy.
And on that note, I think we will call it an episode. Thank you guys for listening. You can reach us at our email address. It's countrystylecomics@gmail.com. There's no spaces in that. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Country Style Comics, produced by Andrew Bowman, Isaac Hawks, and Dustin Jones. Special thank you to Felicia, Angela, and Sarah. Recorded by Barefeet Beats, which is a division of SG Enterprises. SG Enterprises provides computer and network support, DJ services, as well as resume, cover letter writing, and tutoring services. Look them up on Facebook. SG Enterprises. Country Style Comics is a CSC production.